Well, I want to welcome everybody. I'm Beth Offenbacher. I think many of you know me with Public Decisions, and I'm delighted to have the privilege of interviewing author and Australian community engagement practitioner Wendy Sarkissian today for our December Public Forum Book Talk. And I think you may know these book talks feature leading practitioners and thinkers in the field of community engagement. So it couldn't be more appropriate that we're having this conversation with Wendy. I want to remind everybody that the interview portion only of this call is being recorded, and it will be made available later on our website and through iTunes. So just to briefly go over the agenda for the call, we're going to start off with about a 20-minute conversation, an interview with Wendy. I've got a couple of questions to start us off. And then I'll turn off the recorder, and we'll open it up for questions and answers from the group. So let me first introduce Wendy. Some of you know her, and others, this is your first introduction to her. She's someone who's passionate about our future, about the future of work, of housing, of communities, and of citizen participation. She's committed to finding spirited ways to nurture and support an engaged citizenry. Her successful career as consultant and academic in Australia and overseas has provided firsthand knowledge of many in many contexts, from developers' boardrooms to low-income housing estates. She holds a Master of Arts in Literature, a Master's in Town Planning, and a PhD in Environmental Ethics. Building a career as a social planning consultant when there was no such discipline demonstrates that she's a real pioneer. She has led the development of innovative planning and development approaches in an astonishing variety of contexts, which have led her to accrue a total of 40 professional awards, which is quite impressive. She's worked with senior managers and advisors to government departments and private enterprise, primarily in the urban, community, housing, and development sectors. Wendy is widely regarded as a leader in her profession, and she's acclaimed as a humorous and thought-provoking speaker. She is also a fellow of the Planning Institute of Australia and the award-winning author of 9 books on housing and community engagement. Wendy, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you, Beth.
What gave birth to the book, Wendy?
Okay. Thank you. And thanks, everybody. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about my book. I'm in an isolated, small village in the middle of nowhere, so it's wonderful to be connected to the wider world. Well, the first step was back in the late 80s when I found that my planning colleagues were avoiding ESD, as we called it then, ecologically sustainable development. And so I responded to that by closing my business and basically going off and doing a full-time PhD for 4 years on the question of why planners hate nature, which was fantastic. And I wrote a thesis about how planning education should include an ethic of caring for nature. But as often in my life, I was about 10 years early, and nobody really picked it up, and I finally just had to hang out the shingle and go back to being a social planning consultant because I couldn't make a living as an ethicist talking about these issues. And then the world sort of caught up with me, and about 3 and a bit years ago, because kitchen table sustainability has been out a year now. So probably 2 years before that, I was talking to some colleagues here, and I was teaching in a planning course in Vancouver where we were doing an evaluation of the high-rise housing downtown, and one of my students kept saying, you know, I don't think this is sustainable, and I kept saying, I'm sure you're right, but the government thinks it is. So we got to thinking, Nancy Hofer and I, and then two people in Brisbane, Yolana and Steph, and then ultimately Kathy, who's a senior government bureaucrat currently living in Sweden. So a lot of us got to thinking about the problem seems to be that governments and experts were making decisions about sustainability and community members were locked out. It was basically as simple as that. So how to get ordinary people, the people that you folks are involving in community workshops and facilitating their processes, how to get them to be part of the process. And that's essentially what the book is about, is to help ordinary people. I imagined it could be a youth worker in a small town, or a facilitator, somebody working in government, somebody doing housing policy, or working on density or transit, to help ordinary folk feel that they can have a say about sustainability, whatever they thought it might be, and have influence. And so that's what the book's about. And then there, I've written other books that are just about community engagement, but this is about trying to take part in a conversation that appears to be locking out ordinary folk.
Wow. Well, and I think that the point that you made, that really that people could not participate, is a central focus of the book, which I find to be really exciting, and I want to talk a little bit about that. I think I read in the first part where you talked about the goal is really to empower people. And could you,
that's right.
Could you talk a little bit about kind of the context of why people are locked out? What is it about this issue that keeps the mom or the community level person or the non-planner from being a part of that dialogue?
Look, that's a $100,000 question, really, and that's what had me initially flummoxed when I started doing my work. I thought, with respect to the planners back in the late 80s and early 90s, if everybody got literate, we could solve the problem. And I felt really uncomfortable because my background in literature and then in planning, and I don't know anything about ecology, I don't know an ecosystem of a ham sandwich, really. So I sort of looked at my own life, too, as an educated member of the community, and I said, I don't understand the science. I'm scared of the science. This was my position, and it's sort of been my surrogate community member position as well. And also, I'm bamboozled by the economics. I'm just a community member. I really don't understand the International Monetary Fund or what these global economic processes are that are influencing sustainability. And there are all these experts, and the experts have violently different opinions. In my field, for example, in town planning, there are two male, sort of alpha male academic professor experts on density. They can't even sit in the same room with each other. They hate each other so much, and their opinions are so different. So who am I to believe? And also what we're finding from research in Australia, anyway, is that people have stopped trusting government, and they trust Greenpeace or the Conservation Foundation more than they trust government and government experts. So it was really being locked out by a kind of glass ceiling of expertise that ordinary people can't seem to access, I think would be where I was.
Wow. I mean, and that's really fascinating if you think about it, because our government systems are built around places for people to engage and enter in that discussion, and what you're saying is that basically there really wasn't any place that anyone who wasn't an expert could participate in that dialogue.
Yes, and I think there's also a philosophical hurdle that we have to get over as community engagement people. I have taken the position for my whole career, and it's been a long one, that there's huge wisdom in the community, so the community must know best. And it's been a real stretch for me to have to say, sort of this politically incorrect statement, the community needs educating. So, there's another hurdle, too. So often we facilitate without having a body of information that we're presenting. We're dealing with the local people don't want that bridge that's going to go over the wetlands. So we're facilitating that process and hoping that a compromise can be made between them and the proponent who wants to build the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But we rarely bring in a kind of an educational program about what's the value of a wetland and open up that conversation. Community education has been seen as a bit politically incorrect in the past for good left-wing, you know, progressive facilitators, and I think we have to look twice at that. If somebody, you're sitting in a meeting and one person thinks that the whole of Eastern Australia, Southeastern Australia is going to be washed away by coastal processes that are going to become violent and dangerous, and other people think that really there's not, you know, it's just your imagination, we really have to resolve some of those differences in our understandings or the conversation is just going to be a shambles. Does that make sense to you folks? Like, are you having to deal with the contested positions around environmental issues?
Absolutely. That's certainly has been my experience, and very surprising. Not what I expected.
No. I mean, I was in a workshop, like, probably 4 years ago, as a community leader, a really wonderful woman named Liz, and she was saying, Wendy, Daniel, the planner, this is in suburban Sydney, is telling me that we should be living in small houses, and I don't like that. Yeah? Now, Liz doesn't have much formal education, but she's a pretty savvy local woman, probably in her 50s. And I said, Liz, Daniel and I are singing from the same song sheet, and it's called Sustainability, and I'm willing to sit down over lunch with you and explain why small houses and small lots are better than big ones. But, you know, it's part of a big conversation, which we subsequently had. And then subsequently, we organized training in housing design and housing density for the whole community as part of the community renewal program. But Liz is just going, I don't like this small house stuff, Wendy, and why is Daniel banging on about it? And that's how this kitchen table sustainability question presents, I think.
Well, and you know, Wendy, that makes me think about one of the points you make in the book in Chapter 2, where you talk about the different ideas of sustainability, and I really love that picture you have there, that graphic of Ian Lowe's concentric circles, and it's a very powerful image, and, you know, I'm also thinking about the question of, I mean, do ideas of sustainability differ from place to place, or, I mean, do you see that there are similarities? I mean, apart from we think about the economic and, you know, the social, the other elements, are there differences that you've noticed in the projects that you've worked on and the conversations that you've had since the book's come out about what that means?
Definitely. Everybody, well, I think it's a little bit like a continuum of head in the sandness, if you like. I live in a rural area, low-income rural area, about 2 hours drive from Brisbane, and I've recently done the consultation, the community engagement, for the neighboring shire that has a population of about 10,000 people and the poorest postcode in the state of New South Wales. So tiny little villages and then one town with about probably 4,000 people in it, I guess. Now, the council there does not believe in climate change, and when they were offered the opportunity to develop a climate change strategy and get some funding, they wrote to the government and asked them if they could tell them what other councils had done, which basically you could get from looking on the web. They don't believe in climate change. In fact, when I spoke to a council meeting a couple of months ago and presented the social plan in terms of transition and resilience and sustainability planning, it was reported to me that after I left, one of the senior managers said to the full council, I hope you don't believe what she just said. So there's a complete head in the sand view in that rural area. And what's going to happen there is that this community has 300 bridges that they have to maintain, and a lot of them are small, one-lane timber bridges. All of their money is going into maintaining this infrastructure, and local flooding has been an issue now for several years, and it's a climate change issue. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, you'll love this story, most of the people running the emergency volunteer services are elderly women who have never turned on a computer. So they can't access the emergency services warnings that now come by computer and SMS. So you've got a community that's really in danger, very out of touch, quite impoverished and lacking, you know, the sort of intellectual and social capital to get a grip on peak oil, which is a huge issue for them because it's such a car-dependent place, and climate change. One of the schools, the kids need to take 3 buses to get to school in the morning. So if the cost of petrol goes to $10 a liter, you know, this is just going to be a massive problem in this community. So their issues are very different from an inner-city, metropolitan, high-income community that's fighting density increases.
Well, you know, this makes me think of some of the coverage I've been seeing over the weekend for the Copenhagen conference on, you know, the UN conference on global sustainability and climate change. And it just, one of the things that I find really interesting, and this is a theme I've been hearing a lot about lately, is kind of the tension between adaptation and mitigation of climate change. And I mean, I'm interested in your reaction to that because I think it's an important part of this issue here. I guess I'm seeing that sometimes I'm not sure that us as professionals are necessarily oriented toward getting people to take individual action. We're more oriented toward working in large organizations and putting plans together that respond to something. And Could you talk a little bit about your perspectives on that dialogue that's happening now and kind of reflect on your experience with kind of how do we as practitioners on a day-to-day basis kind of bridge those differences?
That's a great question, and there are very many sort of cultural nuances to it. One of the things I would say, having spent my whole working life in Australia, now 41 years, is that community engagement people in Australia, because our population is only 23 million, we work across all forums and all scales, and we don't have the luxury that I think the North Americans do of being able to, you know, work with a particular type of organization or in a particular field. We're all sorts. We're all over the place. So that gives the Australian practitioners a more polyglot experience around something like this. And I think really important when we talk about sustainability and kitchen table sustainability, which is people having the kinds of conversations that they'd be having in the safety of their own kitchen, is to make a really clear distinction about the ethics of mitigation and the ethics of adaptation. If we avoid in our community engagement processes tackling the really difficult problems of mitigation, how do we stop this happening? How do we reduce this this thing that's happening now? How do we actually pull back this whole materialistic culture and try to stop the processes that are contributing to the problem? That's very different from adaptation, which is saying, it's here, we've got it, climate change, peak oil, now how do we adapt? Do we, you know, do we put up dikes? We've had adaptation happening for years, for example, in the Netherlands, but if you look at the Netherlands now, they've actually got mitigation strategies which are partly about putting back natural coastal processes and allowing some flooding to occur in Holland, which I thought was fantastic. So they've got a two-part strategy, and it's nationally, and it's very much got community involvement. But it's easier to go to adaptation and to say that the horse is bolted from the barn. And I'm here, you know, in my work, trying to still tie the horse in the barn and say, don't run away, horse. There's a lot we can do to reduce these ongoing processes that affect the sustainability of our of our planet and our communities, and not just go, okay, well, we lost that route, let's move strictly to adaptation. So this is a sustainability ethics issue, I think.
Of this conversation for a podcast that will be posted on the Public Decisions website. Wendy, let's talk about the eating model, which I think is a fabulous way. I mean, you've touched on some of those pieces, the ethical aspect, the education, but could you kind of just give us a, you know, 10,000-foot view of the eating model and kind of the different pieces of that?
Okay, so we reckon we needed something catchy to capture the components of what would be... you know, a viable, reasonable, community engagement for sustainability model. And so these would be like the basic food groups of the balanced diet if you were doing in community engagement for sustainability or with sustainability. Some of the people who read the book have said, well, actually, what's about sustainability in this? You know, this is just a good model for anything. And I guess that's true, really, any form of engagement should have these components. What tops and tails the eating model? I think that those two are worth talking about first. The first one's education, and as I said, it's so contentious. Like, it's politically dodgy to be talking about educating the community. It sounds elitist and paternalistic, but I think necessary. And the other thing is that within education, we've got two very well-developed and pretty highly contested fields of adult education and environmental education. So our educational principles in Chapter 5 are very much indebted to those two fields. And I remember saying to my younger co-authors, we must respect these fields. We can't cook up anything of our own. So what we said about education, which is that, you know, people need to be supported, not made to feel stupid. They need to be helped where they are with the information that'll help them and learn by doing, and the whole range of educational principles that are leading practice in adults and environmental education. The argument being, basically, you can't share ignorance around problems that are as serious as the end of the world. So we're going to get everybody, in whatever process we're talking about, up to some kind of reasonable level of knowledgeability so we can come to an informed public judgment. That's the education. So that's the E of the eating. The G is governance. And when Kathy Wilkinson, who's one of my co-authors, was talking to me on Skype about the governance model a couple of years ago, she said, well, can you tell me a story about governance? Like, how does this governance thing play out? And I said, well, you know, very often in a public meeting, somebody will say in a sort of passive voice, you know, your input will be taken on board. I'm sure you've heard that. I hope you've not said it yourself, but anyway, your input will be taken on board. So I'm asking, well, on board what? You know, on board some rusty ship that's going to end up, you know, beached somewhere, rusting with all my dreams echoing, you know, around in the hull. Where's the ship going with my input taken on board? Where's it going to dock? And who's going to take the information and, you know, do something with it? And if you can't tell me what the next stages are, the governance process is about the accepting, the analyzing, the handling, and the managing, and the implementing of my input that's being taken on board. I don't want it taken on board, thanks very much. So we've looked at all the governance approaches that need to support a community engagement process, and we've said that basically we have to do the laundry of community engagement. We referred to this great book some of you may have read by Jack Kornfield called After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. It's about how the heart grows wise on the spiritual path. And he interviewed spiritual leaders, and to a person they said, you know, there's a lot of sort of laundry and hard work and just ordinary living in the spiritual life. And I feel there's a parallel with the engagement life, that there's a lot of laundry, there's a lot of setting up protocols and terms of reference for community reference groups and how you vote and do you need a majority and can you have proxies and what's the degree of influence that you have, and all of those governance components, including building people's capacity to take a governance sort of role about their input being taken on board, all of that's part of it. So governance is a multifaceted anchor, if you like, to the eating model. And the A-T-I-N, A is action, and it's also activism. So this is about accepting the role of activists and not demonizing them, but understanding that we're driving around in seatbelts, not because GM thought it was a good idea, but because an outspoken activist did. So not demonizing activists and bringing action-oriented approaches in, that's a sort of double A. T is trust. We see that most projects fall apart because of betrayal or the expectation of betrayal, and so we look very carefully at what is necessary to build trust. I in the eating model is inclusion, and that's about inclusion right across the spectrum. Children, teenagers, all the hard-to-reach groups, and also asking the question, what is our ethical community, and do we include non-human nature as part of our ethical community, like do trees have standing in our conversations? And ends the surprise one, it's the wild card in our model, it's nourishment. We're saying that if we as practitioners are going to facilitate this very, very confronting work, it's about the future of life on Earth, it's very confronting, and sometimes people are very unpleasant. We need to find ways to nourish ourselves as practitioners and also to have our engagement processes themselves be welcoming and hospitable, deeply touching, authentic, and nourishing in the actual processes. And the book that I've just finished, The Creative Community Planning Book, is about that too. So nourishment we see as important because these are bitter times and people are fractious and frightened. And so we're building nourishment into our model.
Thank you for joining us for this public forum book talk. We invite you to join us for future interviews with leading thinkers and practitioners in the field of stakeholder engagement. Visit our website at publicdecisions.com for a complete schedule and to register for upcoming events. For Public Decisions, I'm Beth Offenbacher.